to do and talk to us about tilings and structure and how the world fits together.
Okay, thank you. Fun to be here. Fran, I am giving you something of a rerun of a talk. It's one that I gave at a Texas MAA meeting back a few years ago. And it has to do with a couple of subjects that I really like, one of which is tilings and one of which is physics. You know, one is, you look around us, you see that there's a world out there, and you wonder, why? How? How does this whole thing work? So the order of business is, we don't have a clicker or anything, do we? I'll just keep walking over here and stepping out of the view of the camera. So we're going to do a little bit of actually talking about the real world. I know it's a math department. The real world is supposed to be allergic to that, but we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, about the real world. And then I'm going to present to you some things about aperiodic tilings, and first with one-dimensional tilings and then with tilings of the plane. And this is going to serve as a model for trying to understand some of the questions that we posed about what the world is made of. And then I'm going to show you the particular construction with aperiodic tilings, due to Raphael Robinson and then later extended by Shahar Moses, and give you their example that in some sense is going to answer the question of how could things fit together. Now, to be honest, okay, this is just a two-dimensional model. We don't live in a two-dimensional world. So then I'm going to say a few things about what's different in three dimensions. You know, this isn't really a realistic model of what's happening. It's a model of what sorts of things could be happening. What more do you need to try to plumb three dimensions? And then we're going to see, if there's a little bit of time left, going to talk a little bit about chaos and what chaos has to do with non-periodic tilings. But just as a bit of background, how many people here have heard of the Penrose tilings? Some, not everybody. We're going to get to things kind of like them. How many people have heard of the world? Yeah, you've heard of the world. Okay, so what's it made of? Well, there are fluids out there, and you know, there's the air we're breathing, and you want to understand the structure of a fluid. And that's actually pretty easy. It has no structure. You know, the air that we're breathing is just a bunch of air molecules bouncing around totally randomly. And you really can't say anything about any one molecule. On the other hand, if you want to understand things like how many molecules are there in the right half of the room or the left half of the room, or what's the pressure, or what's the temperature, or what's the energy of an average molecule, or so on. You know, there are lots of, you know, this is studied to death, and we know everything about the probability distribution of positions and velocities and momenta and energy levels and this and that and the other thing. And so any bulk quantity that you care about of the air in the room, it doesn't matter that we don't really understand the microscopic structure. We understand the macroscopic structure of probability. And then at the other end, there are crystals. Crystals are great because what you have is a particular arrangement of atoms, and then the same arrangement of atoms, and the same arrangement of atoms, and they're laid on one after another and after another. And the great thing about crystals is if you understand one little piece of it, you understand the whole thing. So there's a typical example of a structure of a crystal. Right? I mean, this is your basic brick wall. And if you know what's happening right, say with these four bricks, if I want to know anything about what's happening anywhere, all I need to do is look at these four bricks. And I say four bricks because I want to understand what's happening as these three bricks meet and where these three bricks meet. But everything that can happen happens somewhere in the, either at a brick or at where two bricks meet or where three bricks meet or where three bricks meet the other way. So if you understand a little piece of this, you understand the entire pattern. And if I say, oh, we've got this What is happening 3,757,832 miles that away? And you can specify exactly what's happening that, you know, over there, you know, on the assumption that it's a perfect crystal. Great. And you understand a little bit of the wall, you understand the rest. You don't need to zoom out and say, but what happens on a big scale? You understand what's happening on the scale of a brick. Okay, two bricks, or three bricks, or four bricks. And you understand absolutely everything there is to know about the wall. And this is what we call periodic, because if you move the pattern over by the width of a brick, you get the same pattern over again. You move it over by half the width of the brick, and you shift it up or down by the height of a brick, you get the same pattern over again. Call that periodic. So we've got fluids, we've got crystals. Is that everything around us? Well, not really. We also got mixtures. Okay, we've got dirt, we've got sand. You know, what's sand? Well, it's a bunch of little crystals that are mixed in some random way. Nothing really new to say here. Okay, each ingredient might be a crystal. The arrangement of the sand grains is random. So, okay, you need to know a little bit more than when you were studying fluids or crystals, but you don't need to know a whole lot more. Is that everything? We got fluids, we got solids. Are we done?
Glass.
Fluids are solid. Well, yeah, there are glasses. That's a bit more complicated. What? But in fact, we're nowhere close to done. You don't understand that chair because you understand fluids and solids. You don't understand this room. You don't understand this building. You don't understand the cells in your body. Like Jon Snow, you know nothing. You look around you and almost everything is not described simply as a fluid or a crystal. The key thing is, if you want to understand that chair, the chair is made up of definite parts. It's got a, you know, thing to write on, and it's got the brown curved thing that you sit on, and it's got the metal legs, and it's got this bit and that bit, and they're held together with screws, and it's got parts. You have to understand the parts. And you have to understand how the parts fit together to make the big object. And okay, for the chair, it's not all that interesting because the parts themselves aren't very complicated. But you know what's complicated? You're made up of parts. Your parts are made up of smaller parts. You know, you got lots and lots of little parts of each cell, which, you know, you've made up of organs, which are made of tissues, which are made of cells, and the cells have parts, and the cell parts are made up of complicated proteins, and those complicated proteins and nucleic acids and so on are made up of themselves out of even smaller parts. And those smaller parts are made up of atoms. And those atoms are made up of subatomic particles, which make up molecules, which make up macromolecules, which make up bigger clusters, which make up cells, which make up people, which make up get bigger. I mean, you have people organize themselves into communities, where you got sitting in all sorts of counties, in a state, in a country, in a world. And where does the process end? Well, it really doesn't. You know, the world out there is incredibly hierarchical. And if you want to understand anything about how the world really works, you got to study how do the little pieces, you know, get together to make big pieces. Okay. Now, to be fair, most of the really dramatic ways that you talk about a hierarchical structure, you look at a chair and you say, oh, come on, but that's not natural, that's man-made. You know, there was a factory where there was a particular design putting together that chair in a particular way. And biology, okay, it's really complicated, but it took billions of years of evolution to get these structures put up there. So you might be saying, yeah, but those don't count. But even in the world of physics, the Earth has layers. The Earth isn't one subject. It's got a crust, a mantle, an outer core, an inner core. In the crust, it has made up of a whole bunch of different tectonic plates that fit together in a particular way. You know, each plate has different zones. You know, you go to a mine and you have minerals deposited in different veins. It's all complicated. And even if you are interested in just one material, well, 1982, Danny Shechtman discovered these weird materials called quasicrystals. A quasicrystal is something that has many of the hallmarks of a crystal. Particularly if you do a diffraction experiment, you get really sharp peaks. And that used to be considered the hallmark of a crystal. But it's not periodic. Now let me digress a little bit about what happened, what Shechtman did. He made this material, you know, some particular alloy, and then he did a diffraction experiment, and he got a diffraction pattern that was invariant under rotation by 72 degrees. It had five-fold rotational symmetry. And actually, it's also invariant under 180-degree rotation, so it's tenfold rotational symmetry. And this is what you would expect if you had some sort of periodic pattern that was invariant under five-fold rotational symmetry. You know how many periodic patterns there are that are invariant under five-fold rotational symmetry? Discrete patterns. This is a continuous pattern. The entire plane is invariant under five-fold rotational symmetry. That doesn't count. There are none. But when you see that there are none, is let's suppose you had a discrete pattern with a five-fold center of rotational symmetry there. And, you know, it might have several, it's periodic, so there's going to be several points where it's symmetric around. And let's pick two such points that are, you know, as close as possible. So simply speaking, how do you know that it's a minimum distance? Well, you take something within, say, 2% of the inf. Okay, so we've got these two points of rotational symmetry. And now I'm going to draw a 72-degree angle here. And there must be another point of rotational symmetry there. Because from this point of view, everything you see here, you also see over here. That's what it means to be five-fold rotational symmetric. And over here, we can take this line and rotate it by 72 degrees. And get another point of five-fold rotational symmetry. Except that these two points are a whole lot closer than these two points. We assume that these were within a percent of the minimum distance. Contradiction. So you can never have something in the plane, a discrete structure in the plane, with two points of five-fold rotational symmetry. In fact, you can't have anything except two-fold, three-fold, four-fold, or six-fold. If you did this proof with, say, seven-fold symmetry, then the lines would be like this, but you would still have these two points being closer than these two. The only times that it fails is when you have six-fold symmetry, where those two points are so close that they're the same point, and there's no contradiction. Or four-fold symmetry, where they're the same distance that they started, or three-fold symmetry where they're farther than they started, or two-fold symmetry where they're even farther. So the only possible symmetries, if you have a crystal, are two or three or four or six-fold rotational symmetry, and Shechtman found something with five-fold rotational symmetry. What the heck is going on? It took a few years to get people to believe that what he had wasn't just some crazy fake, you know, he made some dumb mistake, that it was real. And eventually the world came around and you know, after 29 years, he got the Nobel Prize. He had the last laugh. But he didn't have the first laugh. The structure of the materials that Shechtman was looking at actually are very much like the tilings that Penrose invented in the 70s, 10 years before Shechtman. So the mathematicians beat the physicists to this game. So what's going on? There's a paradox here. Almost all of the forces in physics are basically local. I say basically because there are a few long-range forces, like gravity. The sun pulls at us even though the sun's very far away. Right? So gravity is an exception. And electromagnetism could be long-range, except that everything is, you know, is neutral. You have an atom with as many positive charges as negative charges. So the forces that you feel from it, the electrons and from the nucleus pretty much balance out once you get past a short distance. So the forces that the way the world works is basically local. And if I want to push this piece of paper with my finger, I'm not actually pushing the whole piece of paper. What I'm doing is I'm pushing one end of the piece of paper. And the atoms at that one end push the atoms that are next to them, and those push the ones that are next to them, those push the ones that are next to them, and you know the force gets carried all the way across. So that I push it one end, that feels a force, which pushes on that, 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 and which then can push on something else. So we think about, you know, doing things long range. Take a 10-foot pole, and I'm pushing the things 10 feet away. But I'm really not. I'm pushing at the near end of the 10-foot pole, and there's this whole bucket brigade of atoms that carry the force to the far end of the 10-foot pole, which is then pushing on something. So physics is all built out of these local forces, and the basic mystery is, how the heck can you get these local forces that are defined at the atomic scale to build things that exist not just in the atomic scale, but at a bigger scale, 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 all the way up to the galactic scale? It's a mystery. Okay. So, is this enough to explain the world? So what we want to figure out is, you know, why are there all these hierarchical structures in the universe, both the natural universe and, well, also biological, which you may not consider natural. And, you know, how are all these microscopic physical forces, you know, how do those give rise to these macroscopic patterns that we see in the world all around us? And, you know, you've got these parts that are assembling into this brickwork. You know, what tells the parts how to assemble? How is the information carried? This is sort of a computer science question. And, you know, can you design some small units that interact only locally, but then assemble into things with large-scale structure? And the answer to the last question is yes. You know, let's see how to make a crystal. Making a crystal is pretty easy. So there's a tile. Looks sort of like the railroad symbol in Monopoly. Okay? And imagine that I gave you a box of those tiles and I said, hey, you've got to fit them together. Well, not hard to see what would happen. The only thing that can go over here to meet this arc is this thing over here. So you're going to wind up with a whole line of these. And then sitting, the only thing that's going to fit this is this. So you're going to have another railroad up and to the right. And the only thing that would fit here is here. So you're going to have another one down to the left, down to the right. And the only way to fit these things together So designing things that fit together periodically is pretty easy. And people have understood this for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. And that's why people thought, for a long time, thought the theory of solids is the theory of crystals. That's all there could possibly be. No matter what the rules are, you're going to wind up with something periodic. And they were wrong. Not everything is crystal. Now, you want something hierarchical, it's a little bit tricky, because within a hierarchy, everything needs to know how it fits inside that hierarchy. And it doesn't have to understand how it fits all the way up. You know, you have to understand where you fit in your team. And between you and the rest of your team, you have to have enough information to figure out where your team fits in the next structure. And between them and all their partners, they have to have enough information to figure out where it fits into the next size structure. But the information can be distributed. It's not that any one person has to know the entire plan. So units have to carry information. Some of the information can be used to build up the structure at the next level. The rest can be passed on to the further level, and the level up to that, and the level up to that. So there's a question of how do you package the information to make things fit? And how do you pass information up the ladder? Okay, so that's the physical world, and what are the big questions of the physical world? So now we're going to learn a little bit about tilings. And we're going to start with one-dimensional tilings. So in one-dimensional world, a tile is just an interval. And we're tiling the line. So you have an interval, followed by another interval, followed by another interval. Of course, they don't have to all be the same kinds of intervals. You might have A tiles and B tiles. So you've got some sequence of A, B, B, A, B, A, B, 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 A, B, B, A, B, A, B, B, A, 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 whatever. You're going to have some sequence. And this world I'm imagining, there are going to be two types of tiles, A and B tiles, and they form two kinds of clusters. One cluster that is two A's followed by a B, and the other kind of cluster is an A followed by two B's. And then these clusters, and let's call the first cluster an A1 and the second cluster a B1. And then we're going to have bigger clusters that you make by either taking two A1s followed by a B1 or by an A1 followed by two B1s. And let's call those an A2 or a B2. And you see where this is headed, right? What's going to happen at the next stage? We either have two A2s followed by a B2 or an A2 followed by two B2s. You'll keep going ad nauseum. Keep on building. And at each stage, the A-type cluster is built out of two A's and a B of the previous level of the hierarchy, and the B structure is built out of an A and two B's of the previous level of the hierarchy. Okay? It's great. You've got this aperiodic structure, and each cluster is and you can, if I give you a big pattern, you can pull it apart and figure out its hierarchy by looking at information. Because you see that every cluster is in the form A something B. So whenever you have an A, so within a cluster, you never have a B followed by an A. Because you either have A, A, B, or A, B, B. You start with an A. At some point, you turn into B's, and you keep going as B's. The only time you change from a B to an A is at the end of a cluster. And at the end of a cluster, you always change from a B to an A. So whenever you see an A preceded by a B, that's the boundary of a cluster. So if you see something like that, I put the dots in there. I could have just said A A B A A B A B B A A B A B B A B B A A B A B B A B B. But I put the dots wherever we had a B followed by an A. And you see, hey, that breaks it up into groups of three. just relabel that and say, oh, here's a B-type cluster followed by an A-type cluster. That must be a boundary of a group of nine. Likewise here. Oh, there must be a boundary over here. Okay, so, you know, locally, there's a way of you know, figuring out the hierarchy for the pattern. There's a problem here. Oh, sorry. So we've got this pattern. Now I claim this is non-periodic. How do we know it's non-periodic? I claim that anything that's hierarchical is going to be non-periodic. And the reason is, suppose I took the whole pattern and I shifted it over by less than the length of a tile. Could I possibly get the same thing back again?
No.
Why not?
Because you'd have the B's followed by an A in a different location.
Right. Well, not only that, you'd have tiles, you know, in one case you'd have tiles here, and in another case you'd have tiles that don't match the locations before, right? The new tiles would overlap with the old tiles. Well, what if you move things by a distance of one or two? Then the new tiles would be in the same locations as the old tiles. But the groups of three wouldn't. The groups of three would now be shifted by one or by two. So if you're going to shift it, you have to do it by at least three so that the groups of three can move over. But if you shift it by less than nine, then the groups of nine overlap. If you shift it by less than 27, the groups of 27 overlap. No matter how much you move it over by, there's going to be some cluster that got shifted over by less than its length. That's the big deal of having structure at large scales. If you have structure at large scales, no matter how much you move it by, you've messed up the structure at that scale. Because you've got to move by multiple of the sizes of the structures. If the structures are arbitrarily big, you've got to move by an arbitrarily far. Any finite motion won't cut it. So when you have one of these hierarchical structures, it's never periodic. So if you move by less than three to the end, the nth level clusters don't line up. Okay. Great. But if I just gave you a box of A's and B's, how would they ever know how to assemble? What's the difference between an A and a B in any way? And if you look at it, this is a picture of an A3 and a B3, and they are absolutely the same except for this one middle position. Now, likewise, if you look at an A4 or B4, an A4 is an A3 followed by an A3 followed by a B3, and a B4 is an A3, a B3, and a B3. So they're the same at the wings, and in the middle, they're the same except for that one middle spot. So suppose you've assembled things into A3s. And B3s, and you want to put them into A4s. There's no label on the outside saying, what am I on the inside? And if things are only connecting locally, there's information about what you are, but it's not being transmitted to the boundary. You need information transmitted to the boundary in order to decide, in order to specify how to put things together. And we got a problem. No matter what rules you put, you're never going to be able to force this. And it's not just a problem with this example, it's a problem with any one-dimensional example. So suppose you had this one-dimensional thing where you had a whole bunch of tile types, maybe 26 different tile types instead of just two. And they satisfy all sorts of really complicated local rules. Well, by the pigeonhole principle, eventually some tile has to be repeated. You know, if you go 20, the length of 27, you have to have one tile appearing twice. So that means that there must be some legal pattern of the form A stuff A, where it satisfies all the rules of what is allowed to connect to what else. But in that case, this periodic pattern satisfies all of the rules. So if you're in one dimension, no matter how clever you are, you can never come up with local rules that force things to be non-periodic or hierarchical. But if we lived out in a one-dimensional world, I'd be done. I would just say, we lose. You can't avoid periodic stuff. One thing might be boring. Fortunately, we don't live in one dimension. Three dimensions, three spatial dimensions plus time. And it turns out that two dimensions is enough to make everything go. So, back in 1960, the logician Hao Wang was asked the question, if I gave you a bunch of tiles and an infinite supply of each of these kinds of tiles, and I say, and rules about which tiles are allowed to touch which other tiles, and they're square tiles that meet full edge to full edge. Is there an algorithm for determining whether they can tile the plane? It was a decidability question. And he basically said, there's got to be an algorithm, because if they tile a plane, they've got to be able to tile a plane in a periodic way. And there's an algorithm for checking whether there can be tiled a plane in a periodic way. You can check up to some distance, which depends on how many different tile types you have. And if you can do it periodic, if you can find something periodic at that scale, you win, and if you can't, you lose, and therefore things will work. But this was had a weak point that he knew it. He didn't present this as a proof. He basically said, look, if we could show that if it can tile periodically, then if it can tile at all, it can tile periodically, then we would have a solution to the problem. And his PhD student, Robert Berger, solved the problem the other way. He came up with a set of 10,000 tile types that can tile the plane but cannot do it periodically. And using these tiles, he actually solved Wang's problem and determined that the tiling problem is indeterminate. There is no algorithm that can answer the question for an arbitrary set of tiles. And then it got improved from 10,000 plus, which is a horrible, nobody can understand an example. Robinson did it with 24 tile types. And then Penrose did it with 20. Now, you may have heard of the Penrose kites and darts, which say, oh, that's only two, that's not 20. But there's two tiles, each of which appears in 10 different orientations. So if you just do up to translations, 20 tiles, not two. And the record, by the way, is, I believe, 13. Okay. So what Moses proved is that if you have some hierarchical pattern, meaning some certain assumption, basically everything is rectangular and the rectangles fit perfectly, that you can come up with a set of tiles, local matching rules, that force you to have exactly that kind of hierarchy. And then you could imagine that the local matching rules are, the local physics says this kind of atom can fit together with this kind of atom in this way. So local physics could force things to have these kinds of hierarchical structures. And then there's the pinwheel tiling. Pinwheel tiling is a hierarchical tiling which is made out of 1 by 2 by root 5 right triangles. You drop the perpendicular here, take the midpoint, drop the perpendicular, and cut it like this. You wind up with 5 congruent triangles. Or to put it another way, you could take 5 triangles to make a cluster of 5. You could take a cluster of 5 fives to make a 25, 5 25s to make it 125. And the cool thing is that if you look at this triangle here, it has the same shape as this group of 5, but it's rotated. Rotated by this angle. That angle is the arctangent of a half, and that's an irrational multiple of pi radians. So if you keep rotating by this angle over and over and over and over again, you never get back to where you started. So this is a tiling which has tiles pointing in infinitely many different directions. Some particular can't possibly be periodic. It's called pinwheel tiling. It was invented by John Conway and Charles Rayton, whose office is just around the corner. And that's a picture of my bathroom. Anyway, what Charles proved is that there is a way to put local matching rules on, you know, on triangular tiles that will work the pinwheel hierarchy. And the next step in this is that Hein, Goodman, Strauss proved that if you, you know, have certain pretty mild assumptions on what kind of self-similar hierarchy you want, that doesn't just have to be rectangular. It can be pretty darn general, and it includes the pinwheel, but includes wilder things as well, that you can always force it with local matching rules. And Hein was a grad student here, by the way. He worked with John Lukian. Not on tilings, but on other stuff. And then he moved into tilings after he graduated. Okay? So, what I want to do is I want to show you how you can get these hierarchical structures from local rules. And Moses' proof was based on Robinson's construction, but it's kind of more general. And I'm going to go back to Robinson's example, except using some of Moses' more general ideas, and to show you how you can get an infinite hierarchical structure from local matching. Robinson's hierarchy. Imagine that you've got just these one-by-one squares, but they're not all the same kind. Some of the squares are red. So a quarter of the squares are red, and they're arranged in that pattern. You can think of it as, say, we've got to break things into two-by-two squares, and we color the northwest corner red. And then we're going to group those red squares into two-by-two blocks. And we're going to take the middle of each block and we're going to color it green. And then we're going to take the green squares and break them into two-by-two blocks. And we're going to color the middle of each green square blue. And then we're going to group the blue squares into two-by-two blocks, and we're going to color the middle of each blue square yellow. And keep going. Right? I only did it for however many levels, but you'd have to come up with more and more and more colors. But this is a hierarchy, that at every stage you've got these centers you form into squares, and in the center of the center, you come up with a new special tile. And this one happens to connect to a yellow guy over here, a yellow guy up there, a yellow guy over there. Didn't have to. Maybe, from another perspective, it could have gone down and across. The question is, how do you make that hierarchy using a finite number of tile types? The way I've described it, it's infinitely many different tile types, because you've got every level we have to define a new color. How do you do it with a finite number of tile types and with a finite number of rules? So, we're going to apply labels to square tiles, finite number of types, local rules on which tiles can touch which other tiles, and we want to force everything to assemble into Robinson's hierarchy. Make a quarter of the tiles red, rest are white, and with local rules you can force the red guys to form this periodic array. Now all the red tiles, in addition to being red, they're going to carry extra labels. And the labels say either northeast, northwest, southeast, or southwest. Okay. So that's the kind of thing that you expect to see. And then we're going to have lines connecting these. Now, I said the red tiles all had to be corner tiles. White tiles can be corner tiles as well, but they don't have to be. So the tile that's right here is going to turn into a corner tile too. But this one and this one and this one and this one aren't. So some white tiles are going to be corner tiles. All red tiles are corner tiles. Okay. Now, any white tiles that aren't corner tiles are going to contain dotted lines or solid lines or single arrows or double arrows or a combination of all of these things. And the lines and the arrows have to continue, and they're the things that force everything to line up correctly. In some sense, those are the bucket brigades carrying information from one part of the diagram to another part. So, four kinds of dotted lines. There are horizontal dotted lines that go to the right of a northeast and to the left of a northwest. It seems backwards, doesn't it? You would expect northwest to be to the left of northeast, wouldn't you? But actually, the dotted lines aren't made to hold the blocks together. It's to hold one block to align it relative to the next block. Now, horizontal dotted lines. Okay. And the horizontal dotted lines are going to carry out an extra label that says whether they're connecting northeast to northwest or whether they're connecting southeast to southwest. Then you've got vertical dotted lines that act similarly in the vertical direction. And the job of the dotted lines is whenever you've got one of these big squares, you know, might be of the first order, might be of the 17th order, you're going to have a dotted line from this corner all the way to this corner. And this dotted line is going to say, I connect northeast to northwest. And this dotted line says, I connect southeast to southwest. And this dotted line says, I connect southeast to northeast. And this dotted line says, I connect southwest to northwest. Okay, what else do we see? Single arrows. Okay. They're like the dotted lines, except that instead of connecting things between squares, keep the big squares lined up, these are the things that run within a square. So within a square, you're going to have these single lines with arrows running from the northwest to the middle of the northern line, from the northeast to the middle of the northern border, from northeast down to the middle of the eastern border, from southeast up to the middle of the eastern border, and so on. And what else do we need? Okay, double arrows. Whenever two single arrows meet, they're going to spawn a double arrow. And double arrows always point towards the center of the square. So if you have these two arrows, here's a northwest and here's a northeast, you have a line of single arrows going this way and a line of single arrows going this way. And eventually they meet somewhere. They all carry the label saying, I'm connecting northwest to northeast. I'm connecting northeast to northwest. When they meet, they say, oh, we must be on the northern border. And they spawn a double arrow pointing south. Okay, there's a picture only of the southern border instead of the northern border. And then the question is, where does a double arrow end? And the rule is a double arrow can only end when you get to a corner tile. And any white corner tiles they can only occur where the double arrows come at them from all directions. So here's what happens. You have these red things, they form a corral. And each one might be northeast, northwest, southeast, southeast, west. Suppose this one happens to be northwest. Coming out of that northwest is going to be these four lines. You've got this solid line that says, I'm looking for a northeast. I'm looking for a southwest. Dotted line saying, I'm connecting to another southwest, dotted line saying I'm connected to another northeast. So that forces this to be a southwest, this to be northeast, this to be a southwest, this to be northeast, which in turn gives you some more lines. And this propagates, and now you've got this periodic array of northwest, northeast, southwest, southeast, northwest, northeast, southwest, southeast. And then you get the double arrows, and that means that this and this and this and this, they must all be white quarter tops. Now, does this one have to be a northwest? Something that says this one has to be northwest. It could be a southeast. But this has to be something. See, we've got this whole, same thing going on over here and over here and over here and over here throughout the plane. We've got this regular array of quarter tops. But once you specify what one of them is, and it has to be something, let's suppose that one happens to be a northeast. Well, then it sends out its arrows and its dotted lines. And that forces these guys to be the right thing. And now you've got this periodic pattern at this level. And now you've got the double lines pointing in the middle. And now you've got that this has to be a quarter tile. And you've got four choices. It might be northeast, might be northwest, might be a southeast, might be a southwest. Whatever choice you make, that fixes the next layer of the hierarchy. And then you're going to have arrows pointing to the middle, and that's going to fix the next level of the hierarchy, and the next level of the hierarchy. And the only way that things can assemble is in this hierarchical way that's not periodic. And that's it. That's the proof. Robinson's proof. So we've got this nice two-dimensional world where there are hypothetical atoms that have these funny rules and this hypothetical set of short-range forces that say what can connect to what. And lo and behold, it assembles things into hierarchical patterns. Okay. We live in three dimensions. Does the three dimensions really work this way? So, in three dimensions, it's actually much easier to carry information than in two dimensions. We saw that in one dimension, there was no way to carry information because you have information trapped in the center of each tile and they're nowhere near the boundaries. In two dimensions, there was enough wiggle room to send a signal this way and a signal this way, and then when they cross, they have to do this and that and the other thing, and we managed to get it to go. In three dimensions, there's lots of room to carry information. And because there's so much information, when you get up, you get more information in the higher level structures than in the lower level structures. You don't use up all the information assembling stuff. There's a surplus of information that allows you to make more and more and more complicated things as you get bigger and bigger and bigger. And as a result, the things you see in the real world are not self-similar. The way that protons and neutrons get together to form nuclei is not the same as the way that nuclei and electrons get together to form atoms, which is not the way that atoms get together to form molecules. And, there are only two kinds of nucleons, protons and neutrons. But you've got, 92 different kinds of naturally occurring elements? More if you count isotopes. How many different molecules are there? How many different macromolecules are there? The world gets more and more complicated as you get bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's basically because there's lots and lots of room for extra information to be stored as you go up the ladder. Stability is hard to understand. The thing about these rules was we said that you can never break the line. There's an information from way over there and way over here, and things come together, and at this point they have to do something. Well, the real world, you have to have some error tolerance. You have to have an ability to say, 1% of the time, we're going to break the rules. You know, the physics says it's energetically favorable to lock in this way, but every once in a while we're going to lock in this way by mistake. And nobody has yet to come up with a good three-dimensional model that's stable against these thermal fluctuations and a certain rate of making mistakes. So that's an open research problem, figuring out how to make it work in three dimensions with a certain rate of allowed errors. Or at least it was an open problem. I got a paper a while ago claiming something in this direction, and I haven't had time to fully digest it. But I think it's an open problem. Last thing, I want to tell you a little bit about tiling spaces and about what this has to do with chaos. So we're done with the structural stability of the universe. We've seen that, hey, in two dimensions, everything works neatly. You can have these local rules. In three dimensions, it's more complicated. But there are open questions. And then what does this have to do with chaos? So here's an example of something chaotic. You've got this is the Lorentz attractor, this is the dynamics of some differential equation that's governing the behavior of weather. And you'll have two different trajectories that are tracking each other almost exactly the same until at some point one of them goes off to the right and one of them goes off to the left, and from then on they never see each other again. Okay. What does this have to do with tilings? Well, the connection is cantor sets. Y'all know what a cantor set is, right? You take the unit interval, remove the middle third, remove the middle third of what's left, remove the middle third of what's left, remove them, and keep going. Well, there's an analog of that in higher dimensions. It's called a matchbox manifold. It's something that locally looks like you have a rectangle and you're going to cut a strip out of the middle. Now you've got two sides, and you're going to cut a strip out of each of those sides. And now you've got four strips, and you've got to cut a little bit out of each of those, and cut a little bit out of each of those and those. So this is something that locally looks like the product of the real line and a cantor set. Now imagine that you have this, and you have a rule saying, okay, when you go off the right side, you reemerge on the left side, you're not just going to wrap it around simply. It's like this whole thing gets mapped over here, and this gets mapped over here, and this gets mapped over here, and then within this, when I said this gets mapped over here, what I mean is that this block gets mapped down here, but this block gets mapped up here, and within that, this pair gets, you get the idea. So if you have one of these spaces that looks like a cantor set across an interval, the way that you wrap around can get very, very complicated. You can have two things that are very, very close, like here and here, and that when they wrap around, they're a little bit farther apart, and when they wrap around, they're eventually in totally different regions. And in fact, the Lorentz attractor has this structure. It's locally the product of a cantor set with an interval. And tiling spaces are always like that. Let me show you why a tiling space is like this. And this, I'm going to give you a two-dimensional example, because one dimension is kind of boring. So two-dimensional example, if I can find an eraser. Here's my favorite two-dimensional tiling space. Tilings. It's called a chair tiling. A chair is basically made of this one kind of tile which can rotate by multiples of 90 degrees. And you can put four chairs together to make a bigger chair according to that pattern. Now, I really just broke one up into four, but imagine doing that and zooming out. And if you do it again, now you've got a pattern of 16. And do it again, you got a pattern of 64. So. And now you got this non-periodic tile. And we're going to look at a space of tiling. We're mathematicians, we like spaces. We take a space of tiling where you say, we're going to consider all ways that you can fit chairs together in this way, with the idea that we'll consider two tilings close if they agree up to a small wiggle on some big ball around the origin. Question, what does the neighborhood of a given tiling look like? What about a tiling that goes off to infinity? And I want to find all the tilings that are close to it in this metric. And close means they agree on a big ball. So I'm going to take everything outside that big ball and erase it. And then I'm going to take what's in that big ball and I'm going to move it over. I can move it over by a little bit. And that gives me some continuous degrees of freedom. Since a two-dimensional tiling is going to be R2, if it were a one-dimensional tiling, it would just be an interval. And then I want to fill in what's out near infinity. But because it's non-periodic, I've got choices. There's more than one way to figure out what tile sits here. And once I've decided which tile fits here, it might be forced for a while, but then there's going to be more than one choice of what fits in here. And then it might be forced for a while, but then there's going to be more than one choice of what fits in here. And I'm going to have to make an infinite number of choices. And that's what a Cantor set is. A Cantor set is what you get when you have to make an infinite number of discrete choices. Are you in the top third or the bottom third? Oh, you're in the bottom third? Well, are you in this piece or in this piece? Oh, you're in this piece? Well, are you in this piece or in this piece? Are you in this piece or in this piece? Are you in this piece or in this piece? A Cantor set is exactly what you get by making an infinite number of discrete choices. And that's what you're doing when you're filling out the rest of the tiling. So the tiling spaces always have continuous degrees of freedom that have to do with moving around, and discrete degrees of freedom which have to do with tinkering with the structure of the tiling near infinity. And my own line of research is studying the topology of these tiling spaces and their dynamics under translation. And lo and behold, it turns out that the dynamics of these tiling spaces are very closely connected to actual dynamical systems. That not only are tiling spaces matchbox manifolds the way I described, but the dynamics is expansive. If you have two things that are very, very, very close, if you move them around a lot, they will eventually not be close. Because suppose you have two tilings that look the same throughout all of Texas, but they disagree in Siberia. Move them over by the distance from Texas to Siberia, now you've got two tilings that disagree right here. Oh, by our definition, that means that they're far, far apart. So you have this tiny differences, after you move things around, result in big differences. That's chaos. And there are these structures, called expanding attractors, which Bob Williams, who was here for many years, was one of the people who developed the theory of expanding attractors in dynamical systems. And there's this theorem of Anderson and Putnam in 98 that basically said every time you have a one-dimensional expanding attractor, it's either the space of one of these self-similar tilings, or it's this thing called a solenoid, which is a kissing cousin of those. So, lo and behold, tiling spaces aren't just the physics, how do things really fit together, they're also the abstract dynamical systems. And with that, I'll stop and let you run.
In this Robinson's example, you said you only find many tile types, but as you sort of iterated this construction, you had some tiles that had just larger and larger numbers of arrows going through them, right?
No, there's a boundedness.
Oh.
Each tile has only a finite number, a bounded number of arrows going through it, because at any given scale, what you've got is here are the corner tiles, and then you're going to wind up with your arrows pointing here. Okay. And and then you're going to have your double arrows pointing here. But you do not have any single arrows running through here. Mm-hmm. Then in here you wind up with another corner tile. And it sends out its single arrows and dotted lines along channels that have never previously had single arrows or double lines. And then these single arrows are going to meet and form double arrows, you know, along rows and columns that have never had anything else.
Okay.
So you so there's always room that, you know, a given tile may have a single arrow pointing this way. It may have a single arrow pointing perpendicular. It may have a double arrow pointing one way. I don't think it ever has a double arrow pointing in two directions. And that's it. It, you know, there's only a finite list. That even though there is, I mean, the rules, I mean, the magic is that the same kind of double arrows that tie things together at level 3 are the same double arrows that tie things together at level 7. So you don't have to invent a whole new language at each hierarchy. You're using the exact same signals. Yes?
So if you have a set of tiles that give you unique tiling, is this necessarily periodic?
Well, when you say unique tiling, you mean up to what? Because, of course, if you take any tiling and you just move it over by half an inch, well, that's another tiling. So you might say it's unique up to translation. Now, if you have something that is unique up to translation, yes, it's periodic. And the reason is that that whenever you have something non-periodic, you're going to have a certain non-uniqueness in how it can be extended. Because suppose I have a non-periodic tiling and I've got some pattern over here. Now, there's only finitely many patterns I could write down in any finite box. Right? In each spot, there might be 4 different tile types and I have 100 spots. So there's 4 to the 100th possibilities of what I get in a 10 by 10 square. But it's still finite. So, by the pigeonhole principle, there have to be two places in my tiling where I see the same pattern. And now I want to compare two different tilings. One tiling is the original tiling, and the other tiling is the original tiling translated by this much. Those two tilings agree exactly here. But they don't agree exactly everywhere. Because if they agreed exactly everywhere, then the original tiling would have been periodic. So if it's non-periodic, that means that when you see this block, there's more than one way to extend outwards. And so that gives you your multiple choices. And then you just do the same argument over a bigger scale and you wind up with another multiple choice, another multiple choice, another multiple choice. So if you have a periodic tiling, if I give you a big enough picture of it, there's one and only one way to extend it out to infinity. So if I give you a piece of my brickwork and I say, oh yeah, you see this piece of brickwork, what is there over in Siberia? You can say exactly. But if I give you this piece of a chair tiling, and you say, hey, what is there over in Siberia? There are going to be multiple answers. The fact that this is sitting here in exactly this way tells you something about what's going on in Siberia. It's not a random tiling. But it doesn't tell you exactly what's going on in Siberia. No matter how much of a finite patch I give you, there's always going to be more than one way to extend it. Yes.
Can you actually quantify like this dependency on distance, like some like decay correlations type thing for
yes.
some tiling?
Yes. What you can do is you can talk about the complexity of the tiling. What people will do is this it works particularly well if you're talking about square tilings, in which case you can always imagine the vertices of the tilings being as integers. But what you can ask is you can say, suppose I give you an L by L square. How many different patterns could you possibly see in that L by L square? And how does it grow with L? So for most of the, for all these hierarchical patterns, the answer is that it grows proportional to L squared. Now, if you had a periodic pattern, it's bounded. That, you know, if it's got a periodic pattern, you know, here you have your bricks. All I have to do is, you know, center one brick and we're done. And you're going to have a finite number of ways to put the brick mod the period. And I don't care how big of an L you take, you still wind up with only a finite number. You still wind up with only a bounded number. So for periodic, it doesn't grow at all. For self-similar, it grows like L squared. If you had a random pattern, it would grow as e to the L squared, e to a constant times L squared, and then you would call that constant the entropy. So there is, you know, a fair amount of work done on these complexity questions. And, you know, what is the slowest that it can grow? What is the fastest that it can grow? You know, if it can, you know, if it grows slower than this much, does it have to be periodic? And it's a little bit tricky because why are you using squares? Why aren't you using rectangles? And who says that the rectangles have to have that there's something wrong with taking one width much, much bigger than the height? Or, you know, why can't you take things with kooky shapes? And so there are some subtleties in trying to define complexity if you don't give yourself a fixed shape to use over and over and over again.
All right, we have no more questions. Let's give our speaker a round of applause.